and welcome to Decoded, a Marriott Digital Services podcast, where we discuss the latest and greatest in digital marketing. Join us, along with special guests and leaders across the travel and digital marketing industries, for new episodes every second Monday. Now, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome back to another episode of MDS Decoded. We are here to bring you the latest news in travel, hospitality, technology, and all that good stuff. My name is Mike Jezaitis, and I'm joined by my partner in time, Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm good. It's almost the fall. Well, I guess it is the fall, and it's my favorite time of year in America, so I'm happy.
It's a good time. I think as we record, we're on day four or so, and it should probably be about 2 weeks since we last spoke to you. So, jumping off from last week before we get to this week, I think you're actually, heading out to the conference we last spoke about? Is that right?
Yeah. So the HSMAA Marketing Strategy Conference starts on Tuesday. There are some events on Monday through our partners in Milestone. And also we've spoken to Tammy before on this podcast, and she'll be there delivering some content on Monday. There is also High Tech happening on Monday, which is a hospitality technology forum, I guess you would put it that way. And then there's also the Revenue Optimization Conference on Wednesday, but I'm not attending that. So looking forward to, just seeing other humans, really, I guess is a good start.
Because as a refresher, this one's in person, right? So you get to see actual humans. That's big.
Yeah, in person, in a state that while I've been to when I was a younger version of Chris, I have not been to since living in the US. So I'm excited to eat some barbecue and see some other people and just learn, I guess, and spend a few days just understanding more about hotel technology, but also marketing strategy, and also learn from peers in other hotel and franchise management companies.
Well, I'm sure we'll have a recap from your return there too, if we actually can ever get you out of the great state of Texas, but we look forward to catching up on that soon. So we will, we'll switch into the news today. We have about six or seven topics we'll go through. Interesting couple of weeks. It's a mix of your kind of standard issue, Google TripAdvisor type news. And then the middle of this, we actually had Apple's California streaming event, which is their the annual September iPhone event with a couple more bells and whistles this year. So we'll go through and you'll probably hear more than your fair share of Chris and Mike talking about the phones we may or may not buy. But I think it's going to be a fun episode. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So first story we bring to you today is about incorrect and accurate information in business listings online. So Search Engine Land had a really good article. It's a poll from a company called Bright Local that does local citation submissions, cleanup, those type of activities. And they basically found that in their survey of just over 1,000 US-based customers, that about 63% of those people they surveyed say they came across some degree of incorrect information related to a business, and it would actually stop them from choosing that business, right? There's some other interesting stats in here about, conflicting information. 77% of people say they saw for the same business conflicting information. 75% said they contacted a business but then didn't do anything about it. And while these are all cool stats, I think the 63% one of incorrect would basically deter them, to me, is kind of shows the value of why we do what we do in MDS, which is making sure that you have a really healthy, solid online presence for your hotel. And anybody that owns a local business could learn from this information as well. The value that's brought from having incorrect information just drops precipitously. If your info is wrong online, people don't want to do business with you. So what do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I read through the study. I think the thing that I found most interesting was that they ranked the sites in which people go to get sources of information. So the first one was Google, the second one was Facebook, third was Yelp, fourth was Instagram, and fifth was using Siri. And I personally use Instagram a lot to find information about a business or a service or something like that when their website or current social presence sucks. So for example, if I have, as I've mentioned before, three young children, we now have a dog, like all of these kind of complexities. And when you go places, you want to know, are they welcome in that environment. And there was a business close to me where I was trying to find information on their website, on their social channels. I couldn't do it. So I went to Instagram, searched the location, looked at other people's photos, saw that there were kids there and dogs there. So we knew that we could take them, which if you think about it, it's kind of strange. They should have that information somewhere on their site.
Yep.
The level of depth of incorrect information. So people saying that they've seen it very, very frequently doesn't surprise me. With everything that's going on over the last 18 months, the level of staffing, all of those good things across businesses, it's not a surprise that there is either inconsistent information because people, oh, we just updated the website and that's okay, but maybe they haven't taken care of their GMB listing or their social platforms or whatever it might be, or they just have neglected it completely. So they're opening hours have changed considerably or whatever it might be. So personally, up-to-date content is absolutely critical. The ability to update it quickly is also important. So if people are taking 24, 48, 72 hours to update content, which in some cases is happening, it's frustrating for customers. And then you've got the other approach where some businesses are just not putting anything there because they're afraid to show opening hours in case they change. And that's even more annoying because customers can't find it. So they then end up going somewhere else. So the level of importance of accurate content is only becoming more and more, especially over the last few months as people look to make sure it's safe and it's welcoming and they can accommodate what they need it to.
I think what you said about looking at Instagram over a website is just particularly troubling to me, right? Where it's, I think with modern tools and technology, and I mean, again, when we talk about local listings, I mean, the stats Chris pulled out indicate like Google's the top dog. They always have been. If you're a business owner, there's a very easy to use Google My Business app that you can literally from your pocket update your hours, your website, add photos. It's no much harder than putting a couple posts on Instagram, right? I think that top section above the, if you have a link in your profile, has really become a really good place to put in there your hours of operation, updates, phone number, all that stuff. And I think it's just particularly troubling that we've gotten to a place where social media is more accurate than one's website or business listings. But so maybe it's a wake-up call for some people, right? And I think this information is, I mean, it's not revolutionary, but I think it's validating that, like, you know, you're absolutely right in your comments of, you know, if you're not accurate, you're not found and you're not going to do business with someone.
Yeah. There was an interesting experience I had recently. I was in a restaurant. It was just my wife and I, and the manager or the owner was serving another table. And one of the guests actually said, "Hey, like I looked on Google and noticed your opening hours were different to what you offered today." I think they on Google it was showing that they opened an hour early, but they'd only just opened. Mm-hmm. And his comment back was like, "Oh, I'm trying to fix it, but Google won't respond." And I smiled, and my wife was like, "Please don't tell him." I was like, I'm not gonna go and like ruin our experience. But I'm like, this is easy stuff. It's not hard, right? Just go and either do what you mentioned, get ownership of your listing, make sure that your website is up to date, and that will change the. Having incorrect information isn't really acceptable anymore.
Well, good on you for the discretion, right? You clearly handled that with a lot of tact.
I just enjoyed my beer, to be honest. So.
Hey, that's good news. So, all right, let's keep the Google train going, and then we'll switch topics. So, the next one is an interesting article out also from Search Engine Land about Google News. So, just as a reminder, Google News is their news aggregator of the various sources of websites that not only feed into Google, but then anything that they scrape or crawl online. And then that news in data, it turns into a tab in search results, right? If you search for a news story, if you're, you know, you want to read about a recent sporting event or whatever happening of the day, you can click news. And then in Google search, you can see all these more articles, right? There's also an app that basically feeds that information alongside other feeds into their dedicated app on iOS or Android. Very similar to like Apple News, where it's this very polished looking aggregation, right? The news they announced today in a release in their Google News blog is they're going to begin to show non-AMP content and send that send that traffic over to publishers' actual website. So this is interesting for a couple of reasons. It sounds a little boring because it's contained to the app, but what it's basically saying is Google is beginning to diversify again outside of their own ecosystem. So to me, the fun part about this is, you know, years ago, Google built this technology called AMP that's like lightning fast rendering, right? I think it's easiest things to ever on Facebook. You see like an instant store and it loads like that. That's what AMP is basically you send all this data to Google and they fast load everything. And it's a very structured, consistent layout, which is nice because you don't get ad pop-ups. It renders real quick. You don't get like a takeover. It's a cool experience. And now what they're saying for the news app is based on data they've provided and the feeds you're sending to them, they're actually going to show if you don't have AMP set up, they're going to actually send you over to that website and link to it. And that is a pretty big change in the strategy that they've done of like keep all the content in Google's walled garden, because the technically the thing that's fascinating here is all those URLs for the data that's fed in on an AMP page, those are all google.com URLs, right? You're never actually going to the publisher's website. So they're kind of opening it up here and sending traffic back to publishers for the first time in a couple of years. So I've got to think that might make people like you, Chris, who read a lot of different news sources, a little bit more excited about the change.
Yeah, I mean, you're clearly going to get access to more content. I think what I found interesting here is if you step back a little bit, as you mentioned, AMP is this kind of HTML framework that enables content to be loaded laser quickly. And it was actually created by Google as a competitor to Facebook Instant Articles and Apple News. So they created this thing, made obviously a lot of people go down this path and they're now then opening it back up again, which I kind of found wildly interesting just from an understanding a business model. I think it gives people access to more information, which is only good. I think the other piece is on desktop, we knew that top stories in the carousel across the top would be open to non-AMP content. And obviously now that is reflected in the app as well. So clearly some companies, it would have been a barrier before because it requires investment, knowledge, expertise. Now that barrier is gone. So that's only a good thing from a transparency of information and just getting more and more content. So I completely welcome it, but I just find the dynamic of the business interesting.
Yeah, I think it's one of those interesting notes where you go back and reverse strategy a little bit. And clearly Google is such a data-driven company. Something has made this happen, right? And I personally always, if I were to get an AMP article, I do that thing where you can kind of like, I think it's like you tap on the eye and it shows you the little icon. And then it shows you the actual publisher's link. And I would click through that because I found it maddening that you couldn't go and look at any other articles from that publisher. And you basically were like, you're in AMP and then you're out of AMP, right? You couldn't really navigate to that publisher well. So I've got to think it's a mix of pressure and then user experience, because everybody over the years has tried like put magazine content in an app. You know, when's the last time you and I talked about Flipboard or something, right? The reality is we never have, because all these things come and go every couple of years. But it's, as you said, it's neat to see the shift back.
Yeah, no, totally.
All right. So the next one we've got is probably this is a juicy bit of news. So last week on the 14th of September, Apple held their California streaming event from, if you watch the recap videos of this, clearly all over California. So they historically have held this conference in person. Then when the pandemic hit, they switched it over to very polished online events. This is one of the first times where they're not going back to their old format by any means, but they're actually taking you outside of their building, and they were quote unquote like streaming from locations around California. So felt a little bit like an ad for the California Visitors Bureau, but you know, it's pretty, so I'll take it. But what was in it was announcements around the next generation of iPhones 13, Apple Watch 7, the new iPad mini, the next regular iPad, some watch updates, some Fitness Plus updates. With a lot of the takeaways being, it's just, you know, a continued iteration on the same product set, right? And I don't think either of us really want to talk about iPad or Apple Watch, but if we dig into the iPhone a little bit, we've got three versions. We've got the Pro, the regular, and the mini of the 13. And the biggest features are the camera's better, the notch is smaller, the battery's better, and there's more more space, which nerdy thing is helpful because you run out of those baseline gigs real quick. But I think my question to you, Chris, is incrementally, this is not even a speed bump. This is like you're hitting a rock and you're moving forward. But what do you think? You gonna buy one?
Probably, because every part of my life is run by Apple. But I think step back a little bit. Their ability to make that production was really cool. Like if you look at the video and just from a marketing perspective, if you step and think, okay, we'll put the product to a side, put the company to a side, the way that they can create such excitement and interest from really a speed bump, as you mentioned, like not major changes in any stretch, but they're able just to create this massive news about it. And I sat and watched many recaps through YouTube of the event, and there was people previewing it. I just thought, wow, they must have a real team behind like kind of the production and everything like that. I think candidly, for me personally, the updates were kind of dull. I think they're good if you're a tech nerd. And I mean that in a way of like, you understand like, oh, this better processor is going to do X, Y, and Z basically. But I want them to sort of come out and blow my mind. So you think about, I want the Samsung flip phone that folds into like four different things and makes like an iPad out of an iPhone, right? Like, that's what I want. And I saw obviously the next day, a lot of things online, people talking about the cameras moving on a slant. And there was a lot of take of like, oh, well, they've just moved them on a slant and now they're that's it. Well, they've been moved on a slant because they're bigger, but you can see how people are making that relationship. It's the iPhone 12, two cameras, iPhone 13, two cameras on a slant. And people. Now, what I did think was kind of cool, again, from a marketing perspective, was the pricing strategy, what they implemented. So if you actually look at the 12 versus the iPhone 13, the price isn't actually madly different. It's probably $50 or so. So
they're in the same price point. That was a big rumor, was that this was going to be the year where they like components cost more and they were just going to up the prices. So yeah, a little shocked to see it in the right range.
Yeah. But if you think about that as a consumer, you're probably going to, I think we had a conversation before and you said, oh, I may go and buy the 12. Well, you may as well just go and buy the 13 because it's, it's quote unquote a better phone and it's only $50 over the life of when you're having the device. I thought the watch stuff was kind of cool. It was very much from a marketing perspective. There wasn't much from a marketeer to get excited about, but from a personal perspective, the design was okay. They just basically expanded the screen over the edge of the watch. So it's kind of more of a, not 360, but kind of, it's sort of more of a sleek design, if you will. And then there's some additional features in there. But again, it's been the same since, well, when did the iWatch come out? Like,
I think it's a long time ago, 10 years. Like, it's been 10 years since that thing came out. And I think you're spot on right of like, if we were to have a poll quote for this episode, it's like, Samsung's building flippable phones and we have cameras on a diagonal. Like, that's exciting.
Yeah. But if you think about the technology inside the iPhone, it's probably like space age. I just don't personally understand it, right? And I think that's where, from a design perspective, I think that's where obviously clearly different consumers want different things. Some want, foldable screens and some want consistency, but an improvement in the technology. And that's probably the angle that they're going at. But again, going back to the product launch, if you can replicate that product launch across any kind of marketing angle,
you win.
You win. Yeah, I mean, that was some seriously cool stuff.
Yeah, no one covers, Microsoft Surface launches or Google I/O like people gravitate to Apple for the production of the year, right, for Zoom Nano. Like, let's talk about that more than what normally is. Like, they have perfected the non-in-person meeting. And the quick thing I'll go back to say is I will probably buy this or 12. I have an SE. I bought it in the beginning of the pandemic when my old screen broke and I needed a new phone and I needed a cheap phone and it served its purpose. I like it, but coming back into the real world, I see literally the difference in a camera from a 12 or an 11. And I'm like, I need to get on board with this. So whatever deal makes the most sense, I'm the nerd that follows processor names. So as long as I get an A15 chip, I'm a happy guy. Next is something that's very near and dear to your heart that you know, I don't know, Chris, you're very, very passionate about, and that's dark mode on things. So I think just to kind of recap everyone that might not know exactly what dark mode is, it's a setting that's generally on, it's on phones, it's on browsers, it's on your computer, it's in your Outlook, that allows you to basically switch from a the normal, what we call light screen, to at a certain time in the day or at your convenience, to what is light is dark, right? If your browser tabs are traditionally gray, they now become black, dark blues, all that stuff. It's built into a lot of OSs at this point. It comes from this developer mindset of, you know, if you're coding intensively, it's frankly a lot harder to continue to look at white than it is black for the majority of the day. And now LinkedIn made some announcements. If you want to kind of explain to us what that is.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I'm kind of passionate about this because once I first got introduced to dark mode, I could understand the logic and the why people implement it. So as you mentioned, dark mode enables you to change the display. So everything is, I guess, instead of being black text on a white background, it's white text on a black background. And the idea there is it reduces the light admitted. And now there's different studies on whether the effect of it, and some people really say it has a benefit and some people say it's negligible. However, dark mode is nothing new. So if you're old enough to remember teletext or CFAX or any of those kind of like on TV kind of information resources from the 90s, that was dark mode, right? It was a black background with yellow, white, and green text. And actually computer screens were originally designed to have dark mode, but to encourage people that weren't programmers to kind of buy and invest in computers, they adjusted it to resemble paper. So that's why it actually went to being a white background with white text. As I mentioned, the benefits are really the hot topic. So some experts say it's easier, it's healthier to read on a dark background and it reduces eye strain. And other studies have completely come to an opposite conclusion of that. And some said it's actually harder. Some say that it increases your battery life. Some say it decreases it. And then some just say, well, frankly, it looks cooler. So again, there's some kind of ideas and different ideas on the solution for it. I personally use it a lot. So I implemented it on my phone. I implemented it on my Mac. The frustrating thing for me before the latest Mac update was there were certain applications within Mac that didn't adopt it. So for example, like you could have it within Outlook, I had dark mode, but on Word I didn't, or in PowerPoint I didn't. Now that seems to be a little bit more consistent, which is good. The news that LinkedIn is now available in dark mode is kind of interesting because it's a website coming out saying you can now toggle your experience based on your own personal preferences, which I find fantastic. I think people should just go try it out. Why we care is not, I mean, users clearly, but marketeers as well. So think about if you have a user that changes their website from being a white background to a black background and your logo is black, it's gonna disappear into the background. Or your thumbnail. Yeah, it's like your thumbnail is a darker color. It's going to fall into the background a little bit and not be able to see it. And I've actually seen a few examples of that lately. So I think, you know, go and have a look at how your content, if you are running a business through LinkedIn or have content on LinkedIn, whether it's a business page or your own personal profile, have a look what it looks like in dark mode and have a look what it looks like in light mode and make sure that it works in both. So if you actually look at the logo for this podcast, we use an orange in there because it pops both in white and against a black background as well. So if you're using a dark background on your phone, you will still see the logo. If you're using a white background, you will also see the logo as well. So yeah, that's actually that idea of when we designed the logo for this podcast, that idea of dark mode was actually in our mind. So I think as marketeers, people now have to start thinking about it because more and more websites are going to come out with this ability to, well, I want a dark mode experience, but Mike, you might be okay with the light mode experience. I'm using it and I really, really like it. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, I mean, you said it so well of like, you don't even think about a logo change with this, right? Like it's normally, you could think of this as a very nerdy or esoteric feature. And I remember there's a website I don't read as much anymore, called Ars Technica. It's like Engadget, The Verge, like those types of sites. And years ago, they had a paid subscription. And Chris, one of the features of that subscription was it changed the color of the HTML. And it's like, for the readers of that news source, that is really important because they are coders and they are nerds that want that type of stuff. But it's moved from those fringes into like, it's a setting that I see, like my mom's got an iPhone SE and she puts on dark mode because it's like at the end of the day, she wants something a little bit lighter. And I do that with my phone. I have the auto setting where it's like from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. I'm on dark mode. I'm on light the rest of the time. But in candor, I cannot do it on desktop. I've tried. I really have. You're one of the influencers that tried to get me to my Mac on dark mode. It just does not work for me. Like I can't really explain it on my phone. Fine. Desktop. I can't do it. I don't know.
It is considerably better now since they made all of the applications be sort of within that dark mode. Before, it was difficult because you were, you know, say in one application and you were having one experience, in another application you were having another experience. Now it's very, very consistent, which is good. I think it's just, personally, have I noticed that my eyes are better or I feel less tired? I couldn't scientifically say that. I just enjoy it more. So.
Very cool. All right. Well, now we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back to talk about TripAdvisor and fun little company called DuckDuckGo.
Interested in learning more about digital marketing? Check out our website, mdsdecoded.com.
Two more stories and one story, one discussion, and we'll wrap it for the day. So the next one comes to us from our friends over at TripAdvisor, and they're continuing to build out the features for their, more or less, their loyalty platform. It's called TripAdvisor Plus. It's a service that they launched a couple months ago that is more or less their version of a rewards program, if you will, right? You stay with, you book hotels or, you know, if there's even homes to rent through TripAdvisor, not really through their meta search, you book it through their platform, and you begin to accumulate points through those bookings, right? So it's an interesting approach of, instead of hotel loyalty, it's you're loyal through this website that you've booked your destinations through. And they've continued to add benefits to it over the last couple of years since they launched, or sorry, months since they launched it. In candor, none of which that I could actually call out. But one that they've added now is an Audible discount. So, I mean, you can get, you know, if you're a TripAdvisor member, you can get $30 off for the year. If you're a Plus member, you get a 90-day free trial. If you're just a regular TripAdvisor member, you get a 30-day free trial of one of the premium tiers of Audible. And Audible is one of those things where we're beginning to see it baked into everything. And if you're not super familiar, it's more or less audiobooks, and increasingly they're creating their own original content. I mean, you could call them podcasts, you could call them exclusive audiobooks. I don't really think it matters. They have all of it, right? It's all things audio at this point, and they're owned by Amazon. So I was curious, Chris, does something like this even matter to you as maybe a non-brand marketer, that TripAdvisor is going to give you an Audible subscription? Or is this something like, I don't understand why this is even hitting the news? Like, what do you think?
No, I get it. I think it's two brands from two different industries, right? You have audio, podcasts, books, and travel, right? Two separate, but using their collective consumer base to drive additional value. So Audible using TripAdvisor to give their members more value, and TripAdvisor using Audible to give their members more value. There's a natural connectivity. So people who are on trips do listen to stuff like podcasts, like various different things. And people who are on trips research on TripAdvisor and all of those good things. So there is a natural connection between the two companies. It's fairly low cost, right? I mean, if you think about it, it's from a consumer perspective, it's not like you're investing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars in it. And you get a benefit from being in either, and they're sort of introducing each other's companies to sort of cross consumer base. So I really like it. I think it's a good marketing tactic. It strikes me a little bit like the Disney Plus marketing strategy, if you think about what they've done, right? They, if you own wireless or you have a certain package through your bank, or, you know, it's always packaged with Netflix, Disney Plus, or something along those lines, right? So cell phone bill, we'll throw in two access codes to Netflix, or my Wi-Fi will give you Disney Plus for 6 months. So there's hundreds of examples of these types of partnerships. I think as long as it makes sense, and this one clearly does, it's great. And I think it's just giving consumers more and more benefits, which can only be a good thing.
Well, this is maybe where we have point counterpoint, and I don't understand this thing at all. Like I think the notion of one thing that jumped out to me that is interesting is they have these kind of trip playlists where basically they're curating together like stories, books, like, you know, what is would be more cool if you're going on a cross country drive and they have, I don't know, On the Road or Travels with Charlie, which are two books I read when I was in my travel younger years, you know, excerpts from that, interviews, like that stuff is very cool. But to me, this is one of those examples of like, you've got a fringe membership service adding in something that you can probably get your own free trial from elsewhere. So I admire your points, but this one's just a head scratcher to me.
I do like, I mean, the playlist thing is cool. I actually think from a, you know, trying to get in the heads of the marketeers piece, that's probably a USP of that kind of partnership versus the reason why they did it. If you think like, so they didn't do it to allow TripAdvisor to go and create content. They could have easily, TripAdvisor could have created that content on their own. Like that's not the reason. I think it's TripAdvisor using Audible's membership base to grow TripAdvisor Plus, and it's Audible using TripAdvisor to grow Audible's membership base and say, okay, well, I'm a member of TripAdvisor. Maybe I will give Audible a try. Maybe they don't know about it. Maybe the trial on Audible is 14 days. Maybe they're getting 30 days now, right? There's, maybe there are some kind of additional benefits with it. But I think, again, you go back to the Disney Plus example, they're not just using Verizon as their mechanism to get out their membership out there. They're everywhere, right? Every membership kind of service that you're buying either includes Netflix or Disney Plus at some point along the purchase funnel. So I'm sure there will be more and more partnerships. If Audible probably are going down that route to grow that membership base, you'll probably get it thrown in with your wireless carrier at some point, or your your cell phone bill or whatever it might be.
Yeah, the Disney Plus one is exactly how I got it, where it was like I went to Unlimited, I got Disney Plus, I have two young kids that like Disney Plus a lot. As soon as that membership or that 6 month trial or whatever was expired, I opted for the auto bill through Verizon. So basically they've basically now become a storefront for Disney Plus. And it's like, that's one of those cool things where if you get into streaming services, reselling streaming services, I think it's fascinating business, right? Like I buy HBO Max through Hulu because HBO has a terrible LG TV app. Right? Like there's all these really weird edge cases that I agree with you. The partnerships business is fascinating. I just don't get this one, but that's why there's different opinions, right?
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of opinions, we've got our next topic of the day. This is less news and a thing happened and more something that I think we just want to spotlight. So, when we talk about opinions, privacy is a very big one. I think, talking from how, you know, Google can intake your data to the way Apple seemingly might not. There's a search engine out there. It's not at all new. It was actually founded in 2008 called DuckDuckGo. And their whole tag is privacy simplified. They are, they bill themselves as a search engine, but they're increasingly that and a privacy blocker service. So in the show notes, we've got a link to a really cool profile on CNET, which is nice to see a legacy 90s tech publication still around. But the basic gist of it is you go to Google and without really knowing it, you are sending them your browser history, your IP address. They are logging all of the queries you do and then kind of creating personal graphs based on you. And they really very much know how to target advertising to Chris Robinson, who lives in Maryland, who is somewhere between 30 and 40, right? And that's very powerful, right? DuckDuckGo's example is they create their own search results with their own indexing engine, or if they don't have data on a query, they will pull Google results, but they will kind of clear it and skin it so that it is their data, but they are removing any of the other aspects that might be personalized and they're giving that data in. They've got Maps now, so they are a very big alternative to Google, where they've built their own privacy-centric search engine where the results are very similar, right? But they're not localized and they're not privacy invasive. So the example I can think of is they still sell advertising because they still need to make money because they're a business. But let's say I search for a phrase about, like, I want new shoes, right? I might see an ad for Zappos or Amazon on DuckDuckGo, and it ends there. There's no data from my site pushed to DuckDuckGo that they then send to the advertiser to make a decision. Whereas in Google, my same shoe things might be a DSW ad for the men's section, and the closest store is 15 miles from you. Like, very different experiences of, like, here's the internet, and then here's how you get there, and maybe there's a promo code for you. It's very different. So I think also kind of maybe like dark mode, this thing was fringes, and now it's seemingly hitting scale. They have cookie blockers you can install. They have a mobile browser that plugs in their search engine. And then again, you don't even have to worry about deleting cookies because it doesn't even log cookies. It's this kind of fascinating forte into privacy that we just wanted to showcase today and kind of just hear some thoughts.
I don't care. I'm just not into it. I'm like, I described it to someone else was asking me about it. I'm like, take my DNA, give me the best experience possible. Like, I want to know where the local store is. I want the men's section. I don't want to be trolling through like collections of shoes, which are not relevant to me or whatever it might be. The added platform is kind of interesting. They serve ads based on what you search, but I want the personalization aspect. I mean, they're getting some cred. There are some celebrities, quote unquote, talking about it, promoting it. But if you actually look at the numbers behind it, which is, as a marketeer, I always love to do. So they actually published their daily average query volume, which I thought was pretty interesting. But last week, their daily average query volume was 90 million. So every day they're having about 90 million searches happening on DuckDuckGo. Last year, overall, it was 56 million, 2019, 36 million. Great. They're growing year over year, which is what you want to see from any business. So over the course of the year, what's that? 1.5 billion search queries, roughly. Now, Google doesn't publish their data. You can't go to Google and say, how many search queries did you have? But there's lots of people out there that estimate what they're doing. They process 63,000 search queries every second, which roughly equates to 5.6 billion searches per day. What DuckDuckGo does in 24 hours, Google does in 24 minutes. That just gives you the idea of scale.
Yep.
I think as a marketeer, clearly there's two sides, right? You've got the marketeer that wants as much information on their customers to be able to give them the most relevant ads to make sure that they are driving up their return on their spend. So for example, if I serve you, Mike, an ad for golf clubs because you are a male between 30 and 40, it's probably not going to be relevant. However, if I serve you a product which is sold within a 10-mile radius of your house that's relevant to a family, it may well be that transaction has a larger propensity to convert than the prior one. But then if you look at it from a consumer perspective, maybe they don't want to give all of that information. I'm just firmly in the camp of, I don't care what the data Google has on me or any other company. Just give me, when I search for something that is relevant that I want A to buy, and don't give me something that I'm not going to buy ultimately. So it's interesting to watch. I just think that Google's got it by by the stranglehold and they're not going to let go, to be honest, no matter how much data they take, because the volume is just so big over the other side of the fence.
Yeah, I think if you normalize the numbers, it's like every study ever shows you globally, Google has like 90% market share, right? And then Yahoo and Bing combined are less than 3%. So the 3% still might be big compared to what DuckDuckGo is processing and your stats of days versus hours or whatever. It's compelling. This is a very fringe audience that the stuff gets some interest and so forth. Where, I mean, I'll be honest, I find it fascinating. I used it a couple years ago when it was in one of those, you know, interest or peak periods where I don't routinely use it. Like, I use Google incognito mode more than maybe your average person because of what we do, have to produce like unpersonalized results. So I'm in incognito mode probably 2 or 3 days a week to try to reproduce something. And that's basically Google's version of DuckDuckGo, right? Like, yeah, it's pretty easy. It's like three button. It's hit the hamburger menu, new window, incognito, boom. They don't track a thing. Well, they say they don't track a thing, right? They probably do. But I'm very much like you in that I want the best experience. I don't really have a ton to hide. And then maybe once a week I clear my cache and cookies just to speed things up. But I'm not doing anything that really, I think, warrants privacy first, but I still think this is maybe cooler than TripAdvisor and Audible.
From a marketeer's understanding, you know, they're clearly getting a lot of traction from it, but I guess it's the balance of what do you want companies to know about you versus the experience that you want on their platform. And if you lean on the side of an experience versus the data that somebody knows about you, you probably don't care. If you're very conscious about the data that someone has on you, then maybe you do care. But it comes down to the experience. I want the best possible experience when searching or looking up information. And, you know, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about flight prices. Again, doing research, I only fly on one subset of airlines, but I use Google Flights to do my research because the experience is 100 times better than going directly to that airline. Mm-hmm. Again, it all comes down to experience. But now Google knows that I'm planning a trip between a certain window to a certain location, but I'm going to probably get bombarded by adverts over the next, you know, few days and weeks. But again, if someone can serve me up a better flight time or price, then all have at it, right? I'll take it all day long.
Yeah, the last piece I'll say on this that is it's counter to the privacy piece is, like, I always find it interesting when search engines pop up, gain a little bit of relevancy. Do they introduce a feature that inspires Google to take it and run with it, and then vice versa, right? So I think if you really go back into history, there was a site called Mahalo that was a human created search engine. It's not even online anymore. And that's actually where Google took Knowledge Graph from. Was basically what they do is, like, instead of having machines run everything and query it, they basically had, like, I think they call it like human editors, and basically they pick the search order and rank and everything. And then they try to give you like quick answers in their search results. I'm like, oh, you want to know this customer service number? Here it is, right? All that stuff, ultimately, Google sucked it up and made it Knowledge Graph and what was eventually structured data. So I look at DuckDuckGo and think, like, what are the features that they've created that Google might take next? But then you look at DuckDuckGo, and it basically looks like Google SERPs with a different logo. Like, they have a Knowledge Graph, they have Universal Search, they have carousels, they have a map overlay. So to me, what's interesting is the privacy stuff is very important right now, right? And then are they going to produce something that gets a lot of interest?
Yeah, you reminded me of when you said let's go back in time. So do you remember Ask Jeeves? Did you ever use that?
I did. Yes.
It's still around.
No, it is.
Yeah. I just looked it up. It's ask.com. So I vividly remember it. That was kind of the first search engine that I would use as, like, being a kid of being allowed online. And there was the butler, and you would ask it questions. And it was kind of like the long tail search of now, right? So it's like, tell me about hotels in New York or whatever it might be, and it would tell you about hotels in New York, and you'd be like, whoa, this is amazing. And now clearly they got crushed, but it's interesting that their experience is basically Google.
It's
full of ads as well. Like the first, was it 1, 2, 3, 4 placements are ads, and then the bottom 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 placements are ads, and then the ones in the middle are natural listings. It's kind of interesting, but I didn't even think that was
still alive. That one's going swimmingly. Yeah, I remember using that. That was, I think I learned about the internet in the library in middle school. Yeah, I think it was Ask Jeeves, Dogpile, Hotbot, all that fun stuff.
They have an article on the Super Bowl as their top trending article.
Oh, great.
Okay. So that they're going back to our first point of keeping content updated and relevant. Ask and clearly not doing it, because their top trending article is from April 15th, 2021. So,
On that note, we thank you for getting back in the time machine with us and enjoying our wide-ranging conversation. If you have any, if you like the podcast, please consider give us a review or a rating in iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we wish Chris a safe flight and good journey. And I'm excited to catch up about HSMAI with you in 2 weeks. Does that work?
Yeah. We'll do a full download and regroup of it. And we'll give everyone the inside scoop about what happened at our first in-person event in 18 months.
And maybe we can get a photo of Chris in the cowboy hat. You know,
it's going to happen. There's not a maybe about it. I'm coming home with a cowboy hat.
Well, cheerio, cowboy. See you soon.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening. This was Decoded, a Marriott Digital Services podcast. Be sure to leave us a review. It really does help other people find the show. And of course, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Do you have a question or topic you would like us to discuss on the show? We'd love to hear from you. Email us at mds@marriott.com. And remember, you can learn more about digital marketing and gain travel insights on our website at mdsdecoded.com. See you next time.